Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Calajaris, Vice President of Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute, and the host for today's episode. And today, I'm extremely excited to have Cindy Brummer on, who is CEO of Standard Beagle Studio, an award-winning product design and research agency that helps B2B SaaS companies fuel growth, and just a passionate leader and a kind of an inspired designer that I love to chat with. So thank you so much for joining us, Cindy.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
All right. So let's get people who haven't had the pleasure of speaking with you before to get to know a little bit about you. Like, tell me about your journey into design and why you are so passionate about what you do.
Oh my gosh. How long do we have to talk about my journey? It is the most winding path ever. I usually use one of those pictures of like the squiggly line that just goes in all different directions. I actually started my whole career as a TV news producer. So like very different career and just wasn't a good fit. I was there for, about 3-4 years. I have no idea. It was so long ago. And then tried to get a job like outside of TV only to realize that nobody wants to hire a washed up television news producer other than other TV station. But I landed an opportunity to be a web producer, which, God, it was so long ago. The web still was like really new. It was before YouTube. I mean, this is how long ago it was. And I battled reporters to get their stories on the web. They didn't want to put their story on the website until after it aired. This is how long ago it was, right? Oh, wow. But the cool thing was that I started to get really interested in it because I was like, oh, how is this stuff made? So this is what I do best. I talk people into stuff. So I talked my boss into, hey, will you pay for me to go take some design, like web design classes at ACC, which is the Austin Community College, because they have this program. And they were like, yeah, sure. So I got them to pay for it. And I started taking these classes and I was like, oh, this is really cool. And I just started getting more and more into it. You can only go so far with like a formal classes, right? So I was just devouring everything I could. I was reading stuff from Smashing Magazine, which is still around. They still are a great source. Mm-hmm. I went to like every conference I could afford. So the Event Apart people came through Austin. I was there. I would learn so much. And of course, at the time, I heard the term experience designer. And I was like, this is great. This is what I do. And I told people that and they were like, you're a what? Like nobody understood what the term was, right? So I had to change it to like web designer, which didn't feel right because I wanted to do usability testing, do all this stuff that was part of it. And nobody understood what it was that I talked to. Anyway, so I'm going along this path. I'm taking freelance gigs. I finally got someone to hire me to do that. And it just, I never figured out like what like really clicked with me except for all of this research and the design stuff. But I was doing it all on my own. I ended up going off on my own and like just trying to explain what I did. It was just really hard. And one day I was going to do data analytics. I was excited. I'm going to learn this because this is the thing. That was not a good fit for me either. I was like, no, this is not going to work. But I found this class on design thinking. And I took this class and I was like, oh, this is what I do. And I was just fascinated by this whole creative process of like learning about people. I was like, this is the stuff I'm already doing. There's like terms for it. Like, I had no idea. So then I started talking about, hey, have you heard about this UX stuff? Like, and people were like, yeah. Like all of a sudden, I'm like, oh my gosh, I found the name.
You found your people.
So I'm like talking about it and talking about it. And then lo and behold, I get someone like, hey, would you like to teach? And then all of a sudden I was like, not only like talking about it, but I was like teaching people about it and realizing I had lots and lots of gaps. But as I was teaching it, I was learning it, and I just became, I just fell in love with the whole thing. And that's my winding squiggly line path.
It's interesting though, because so many of the designers that I talk to, particularly the ones I think of that are really being sort of like thought leaders in the field, have this kind of left and right background. And I think part of it is just sort of also just like, as designers, we like to learn things, right? And so exploring is part of how we enjoy and how we learn. And so it makes sense that it's like, oh, I can hear it. And also the listeners can't hear your face, but your face when you found the words, right? Like that you found the words and then you found the people and you could talk about it with others who understood it was just like pure, like light bulb, like lights went on, because there is also, again, a lot of enthusiasm and excitement for what we do and what kind of impact we can have.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It was just the coolest thing. And it's just so cool to be able to like teach people too. Like I really think, you know, I knew a lot, right? Like I had done a ton of stuff, not well, but I learned a lot, right? But then when I started teaching it, just I felt like I was starting to master it, right? Like just teaching it to other people helps you like figure out what works, what doesn't. And as I was teaching it, I was implementing it in my own work. It was just the coolest thing. I tell people, I eat, sleep, and breathe UX because I walk around. I even taught my kids this. I will walk around and be like, that's a bad user experience, right? Like, or I'll go through a door and I'll be like, oh, did you see that? That was a Norman door, right? Like, little things. Little things.
And when you teach, you have to break down to explain what it is you do. And often like there's still a lot of what we do that we do like instinct and gut. And this is sometimes why it's hard to explain to other people. You're like, you know, cause it's the right thing. And they're like, no, how do you know that? And like, someone's like, cause I know.
Right.
But when you teach, you have to try and break it down, like give it a rubric that helps people do that. And that really does help you refine and polish. And like, really, I can see why that was a way to teach also as a way to learn.
Yeah, no, totally. Have you ever read the book? I think Malcolm Gladwell talked about it in one of his books. He talks about this whole idea of chicken sexing. I think it's called chicken sexing.
I have not read about chicken sexing, but I'm interested, Cindy. Tell me more.
So when you have the little chicks, right? Mm-hmm. How do you tell the difference between a male chick and a female chick? No, it's like almost impossible, except if you're an experienced, like if you know, like deep down, like there are people who are trained to do that, right? But it's so deep in their brain that they don't know how to explain it to other people of how to tell the difference. So literally the only way to learn the difference is to try, like do it and have that person standing behind you and go, nope, yep, nope, right? And then you go over time and figure it out, right? So that's kind of how I feel sometimes, or at least I did about UX. And people would be like, well, how do you know to do that? I'm like, right? And then you have to really break it down because like, I don't know. It's just, I just do.
But then when you're trying to get the resources or convince your organization or your clients to do that, the power of being able to explain the why is really big. But it isn't something we spend a lot of time in. Partly we take it for granted. A lot of what we are really good at, we're like, we don't think it's that special sauce. It's like, what we do. It's super fun. We like it, right?
Very right. Yeah, totally.
So you took this winding path through the chicken sexing, but you started your own agency. So my first question is, because it's been bugging me the whole time, is how did you come up with the name Standard Beagle Studio?
Oh my God. So when I was a sole proprietor, I had a company called House on Paint, and I had a client that went through a trademark infringement lawsuit.
Oh.
And I thought, ooh, House on Paint is awfully close to the House of Pain. That's kind of weird. So I decided that I was going to rebrand, but I couldn't figure out a name. And I went through like, oh God, it felt like forever trying to figure out. And of course, all those companies, they take out vowels and things like everybody had taken those names. And one morning I'm sitting in the office and my husband runs in and he goes, oh, Standard Beagle. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he points at our dog and he goes, Benny. So Benny was a treeing walker coonhound. She looked like a giant beagle. And most people don't know what that breed is. So they see her and they go, is that a beagle? And we go, oh, she's a standard beagle. Like the poodle, right? So I knew like if people were cool and they go, oh yeah, like the standard poodle. I'd be like, yeah. So, and nobody had that domain name. So that's really like, that isn't that how you make a decision about a company? Is the domain name available? Yeah, okay, cool.
Right, the business name, you're like, never mind.
So it just kind of took off from there. So Benny's, you know, passed, obviously it's been a long time, but you know, she lives on in our mascot.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Right? Okay. So your agency mostly focuses, I don't know if solely, but does a lot of like SaaS clients and software clients, right?
Yeah.
Which is a, you know, and I have worked in software in my past. I love it, but it is different. And it's some ways more complex and especially in sort of the B2B world. So talk to me a little bit about sort of why that niche and why it is different and maybe even some of the similarities.
Yeah. We started moving into this field kind of more officially within the past couple of years just because it just is so much more challenging. And I am kind of the person that gets bored. I've done so many marketing sites. God love them. There's a place for them. I love them. But the patterns are pretty similar. Yeah. And what I found was that working on these, you know, B2B type projects, there was always something unique. Like, yeah, there are similarities in personas with the B2B clients, but there's usually the stakeholders bring in the interesting piece, right? Mm-hmm, there's always some sort of passion at play on the stakeholder side that you have to kind of sink your teeth into, and their challenges and their business goals are often very different. And that's what I found so interesting, right? Usually on a standard website, you're just trying to get somebody to convert and, you know, buy the product or sign up for the service, you know, on that B2C side. But when you're working with a B2B client, the end user is trying to complete a task. They're trying to get something done. And that could be very different from like a developer using this platform to help set up really complex integrations to a doctor who's trying to have, you know, something analyzed on their end, or, you know, nurses that are completing clinical trials. Like there's so much difference in what they're trying to complete. It really brings this new aspect of like you're learning something about an industry every single time. And it's just fascinating to me. And then, you know, the levels of, and this probably is the same, you know, for B2C software, but the levels of users, right? Mm-hmm. You have that first time experience, the beginner user, the idea being that you want to get them to intermediate as quickly as possible. How do you do that? And then also, how do you make sure that the advanced user is, you know, also being served without overwhelming everybody? There's just so much that just to peel back, I just find it fascinating.
Yeah.
Just that whole feel.
You know, I agree. Also, I think it's interesting because you talk about stakeholders. And I think that like getting stakeholders on board is one of the reasons within in a lot of organizations that there feels like there's tension there and there's a disconnect. You can't get them to understand the value. They won't give me the time. I won't take much time, but I need time. I can make a big difference, right? And you get like new stakeholders all the time when you're an agency, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas we have to win them over like once, and it will take us a while, but like once, and then they're there. I would love, as someone who has to do this on a regular basis, understand the stakeholders and bring them along. What are some of the techniques that you use in that area that some listeners who could leverage internally with their own stakeholders?
Ooh, I'm already writing a blog article about this because there's just so much going on, right? Like I've seen, you know, I've looked this up, like how do you deal with stakeholders? And there's a lot of advice around, well, first you have to identify the stakeholders and then you have to understand their pain points and their frustrations and their goals. And then you have to like put them in a grid on like interest and power. And to me, I'm sorry, I'm one of those people that I'm moving too fast to put anybody on a grid. And besides the fact that I find that a lot of times that can lead you astray because there's a lot going on interpersonally in companies that I definitely don't always know about. If you're inside a company, that might be different. You might know all the gossip that's going on or what someone's dealing with. So you're not only dealing with their their job, but you're also dealing with the emotions that are going on. And I'm sorry, but I don't think anybody can separate home from work or anything like that. It's just, we do our best, but it just can't be separated. So I start at the psychological level with just trying to, first of all, build rapport. I mean, that's the biggest thing for me. When I'm an outsider, they're coming to us. Often they already are sold that something needs to happen, but the approach might not necessarily be something. So I have to build trust as quickly as possible. And that could be beneficial no matter where you are.
Yeah, it's trust just building is that trust. Be key.
Yeah. And that comes through the confidence with which you speak, not being kind of like namby-pamby. I hate that word, but having things like when your voice goes up, is that okay? Can you think, like things like that. You just have to say with some sort of authority that this is happening. And then being aware of basic needs. I read this awesome book called Your Brain at Work by Dr. David Rock. And he talks about what he calls the SCARF model. So SCARF being an acronym for status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. Hmm. And I found that, status, certainty, and relatedness are most applicable with a stakeholder. These all five things, though, are basic needs that our brain has. So when we feel like we have those, there's a reward that goes off in our brain. And when we feel threatened, our brain reacts negatively. So we have these visceral reactions that we can't always control. So in terms of status, we're always comparing our status to another person, always. We always want to feel like we have higher status. So this is the most important one that I see with stakeholders is if they feel threatened, like you're diminishing their status in some way, then that's going to be a terrible relationship.
Yeah.
With them, right? So you have to do everything you can to help protect their feeling of status, which a lot of people go like, well, I don't need to do that. Why should I do that, right? But if you want to have a smooth relationship, and you can do it in very subtle ways, you can make sure that you're listening to them. You can make sure that you are, letting them make the choice of like, let's talk about this first. Sometimes I have to make it seem like the idea came from them.
Yeah.
Like people aren't going to do like what they are not going to do. They're just not going to, if they don't like it, they're not going to do it. Right. So if you have an idea, sometimes it helps just kind of plant it, but then them feel like, oh yeah, I came up with that.
Yep.
There's a danger there, right? You don't want someone to take credit for your work. But in my line of work, it doesn't usually matter because I'm just handing it over anyway.
As a consultant, that's fine. They're going to, and there is a balance there, right? The planting the seed is more likely to get yes. And that can be a good way the first time, right? But then there is a point where you're like, well, then they're going to, always a balance.
Yeah. Yeah. So, just feel when the boss comes in, right? You gotta make sure that they feel like the boss. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see how other people defer to that, person that has the higher status. It's not always the boss. It could be another influencer on the team. And you just have to be aware of those people. And then when it comes to certainty, this is another area. Like if people feel uncertain about the outcome of the project that you're working on, they're going to be really nervous. They're going to have, again, they're going to feel threatened and their brain is going to react. So by having open and honest communication, they should feel like you're telling them everything that they need to know. And it makes them feel better. I literally just talked to not a client, but a prospective client today, and they have lost trust in one of their teams because they feel like they're not being told everything.
Yeah.
Right. And so now they're hunting around for someone else. So you've got to keep that in mind that certainty really matters. And then relatedness, when people feel like they're part of a cohesive team, they're related, they're part of it. But when there's disconnect, again, there's the reaction. So if someone like a stakeholder feels that they're not part of the process of the decision-making, of being heard, of the brainstorming, they're kind of left out, that is going to negatively affect the project as well. So you have to take steps to somehow include. You don't have to always come to agreement, but coming to a commitment and everybody seeing we all participated, that's the most important thing there.
Yeah.
Participation.
And I would think too, when we're talking about trust and buy-in too, like I know that one of the areas, one of your favorite areas is sort of the research and the usability testing. And there is, if they trust you on your process, then the information you get from that is so valuable. Because if they trust that you approach that process correctly, then that information is, it is the voice of the customer, right? And it's a rallying thing around, and it does take out some of the opinions. But if they don't trust you, they won't trust the data, even when that just seems insane to us. We're like, how could you not trust the data? But they won't. The messenger will matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't have like all of it available for them, they absolutely will not listen to it. But, you know, sometimes that's the really hard thing too, is like, if you present all of it to them and it's not what they want to hear, that's a totally different thing, you know?
Yep.
And so that's really hard. That's why you have to work on all the other stuff first before, because otherwise there's no convincing them.
No, nope. Very true. No amount of data will sometimes help you in those situations. But
yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating stuff. The human brain and how we do interpersonal stuff. And I came up with, well, I'm sure I'm not the only person that came up with it, but I've been using, or at least pushing for this. It's kind of a discovery meeting. I call it the vision meeting. When you bring, it's best at the beginning of a project, especially one where you think that people are going to have strong opinions. You need to get some trust early on. So bringing everybody together, doing a little bit of an icebreaker, but having specific questions that you want to ask, and then getting everybody to participate in terms of like giving those things. And I do it with post-it notes and Sharpies. And I'll say, okay, what is the most important thing that we need to come to a decision on? Everybody writes down all their ideas. Everybody puts it up on the whiteboard, and then they go in and sort it. And then they, you know, ultimately they can see where everybody stands, and then it brings them more into alignment. So we did this with a client. It's been several years now, and the head of the department was very opinionated, and I knew he was going to be tough. So I was like, okay, we need to make sure that we get his voice in there. And as a result of that vision meeting and presenting, here's the report. They were all there though. They all knew. He became our biggest advocate. So when we had to go in front of the board and present, and then they, you know, questioned us, he was the first person to jump up and go, there's data, there's data, there's data. So that one 2-hour session benefited us for the entire 6-month project. I mean, it was the best investment in time we ever made.
Excellent. All right. So many questions I want to talk to you about. Well, so many things. But one of the things I was thinking about as we talked about your squiggly line into design was kind of when you think about UX designers and new people entering the workforce, what kind of skill sets, what kind of experiences do you think they should have? Or at least like, what should they be thinking about building? They have a lot of the core UX skills, they know the how-tos, but what are the other muscles that you think are so important for them to focus on?
Yeah. Oh, great question. You know, honestly, okay. So one of them is the soft skills around, you know, being able to communicate your ideas. This is really hard for people to be able to speak in a way that is persuasive. So it's persuasive speech, being able to interview people is also, you know, it's the I'm speaking, but I'm also listening. Because if you can conduct a really solid user interview where you're just listening and taking stuff in, you can do that. You can repeat that thing all throughout the organization. So that's really important. Being able to work in a team is so important. And I see students when they come out of boot camp, some of them are really good at it and some of them are still struggling.
Yeah.
They don't know how to, you know, they don't understand what teamwork necessarily means. So like teamwork isn't just going along with everybody. It's a give and take, and it's also holding people accountable. And I find that that's the part that is the disconnect, that someone who is more advanced is going to understand that, but someone who's new doesn't necessarily understand what's going on there. But then all the extra stuff, like don't give up on all just because you're a UX designer doesn't mean that you stop learning about everything else. I have this, I think I cut it out when I was in 11th grade. It was from my journalism teacher. And it was like the 10 commandments for reporters, but I use it as like 10 commandments for UX designers. And one of them is stock the mental cupboard. And it is all about reading widely, just learning as much as you can about everything. I took a product management boot camp. I wanted to understand what it was like on the product management side. And I do a lot of that now as a result, but I didn't understand what went into it. I did a fellowship program where I tried to understand what was going on in terms of like creating a product from scratch, all the exploratory interviews. I didn't have any experience before that. And then just constantly learning. That muscle of flexing, and then you're not just reading UX books. Mm-hmm. Go read other books and then go try it out. I have a long list, but those are the top ones that came to mind right now.
And I think that the things we can learn or things we can apply to our work and from something completely different is always a really fast, one of my favorite little like brain synapses, you know, neuron things going is when you're like, oh, that, you know, book I was reading about wars in France suddenly has a tactic that makes me think, oh, they could do this differently. And like, it's things you wouldn't necessarily like search out, but it is somewhere where for me, some of the most exciting and interesting and sort of innovative, but you know, bigger distance ideas comes from.
Yeah. I mean, even like I'm fascinated by the idea of leadership right now. And because it's hard. Like leadership is really hard and you need to have leadership skills too when you're moving in, no matter what position you are in your company. Mm-hmm. And I find that watching TV actually teaches me a lot about leadership because I mean, there's Ted Lasso. I mean, that's a no-brainer, right? Yes. But I watched a documentary on Winston Churchill and I'm sitting there going, wow, well, look at that grit. He had doubt. Like, what can I learn from this as a leader, right? I mean, all those little things or even leadership failures. So I watched a documentary on the Waco standoff happened forever ago.
The one with the negotiators on the back.
Yes.
It. Same thing. Yes. I was like, oh
my gosh. So the lack of team alignment, I was like, whoa. Because, you know, I'm going to give away my age. I was in high school when it happened. So like I was not paying attention. So it was like mind blowing to me, like what was going on. And I love that book. What is it? Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss, where he talks about the negotiation. Such a good book. I totally recommend it for anybody.
The negotiating, it was fascinating and like watch it. I won't give it away, but like one team is working in a very specific direction and are all aligned. And another team just comes in and like puts the work effort back an enormous amount. And you're just like, what is happening? Yeah, it was really very good. Oh,
the dysfunction. What we hope never happens in our organizations, right? So I find that watching things where other people are screwing up makes my status feel a little bit better, right?
Well, I've never done that.
and I just hope that it's going to be a lesson that I can learn from and not repeat, you know, because we all make mistakes, right? I mean,
absolutely.
That's what evolution of ourselves is all about. But there's a lot out there. And here's the other thing, right? For someone new, the skill to be comfortable with ambiguity. Because you're not going to know everything.
Yep.
I'm going to tell you, you know who I saw speak last week? Ice-T. And, you know, the rapper?
Yeah.
A rapper, actor, all that, right? So he was talking about like just not, you know, being a hustler means just like we're all hustling. We don't complain. We just figure it out.
Yep.
And that's kind of like what we're given in our jobs. We just have to do it. We just have to figure out how to make it happen. We can't sit there and say, why did they give me this? I don't know. Why life, you know, right?
Or paralysis while you're waiting for the perfect answer is something I see a lot, especially from people early in their career where they've come from something academic where it was the case study worked out perfect. It was black and white. And it's never going to be that clear. At some point, you're going to have to fill in a gap and make a decision. And just know what you're watching for so you know whether it was right or not, right? Like, but that can be really hard for people.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See that a lot on the product side with research, right? They're like, but if I ask more people, I'm like, well, that's true. But like, at some point.
Can we just get to a pattern of people? We don't need to ask the whole world, you know? we're all going to make bad decisions at some point, but we do the best we can given the information that we have at the time. And we just have to learn how to negotiate that with ourselves and then also take that and then move on from it. And we're going to make more bad decisions. Yep. We just have to be, you know, okay with that.
Yeah. You know? All right, I have two other areas I want to talk about. A little bit of a departure, but two things. One is sort of like one of those sort of fundamental pillars of design that I think from conversations with you, you see a shift in, a necessary shift in. And the other is something every single person listening to this is certainly thinking about and reading about as well. So we're going to start with the first one, okay, which is personas.
Oh. Right?
We talked a little bit about personas and I thought your kind of perspective here was really, really interesting. And
yeah,
so I would love to kind of dig into that.
Oh, I am so opinionated about personas.
I know, I love that.
They are all almost crap. just most of what is created out there is total crap. And I am equally, you know, I made so many that were so bad. And I even taught like so bad. Like we create these personas because we think we have to. We start with like, oh, here's a great picture and I'm going to name the person and they're like 40 years old. They're a marketing person, right? Like we start with that and then we build the story around it and we make them look beautiful. Have you ever seen those beautiful ones?
They're always attractive. Yes.
They're so gorgeous. Yes. And yet they're completely useless because when we have to actually make decisions from them, they're not serving the purpose that they need to. So what happens is that people start to question them and like, why are we even making them? We don't need them at all. So I really got interested in this topic a few years ago and I started looking around to see, well, okay, is there one way to do this that I'm just missing? And right, I could not find it. And I was like, there's got to be a better way. So I started thinking about what is the way to unify all of these things together and make something that's useful. And so it occurred to me that we should be thinking about instead of that outward appearance of the persona, we should really be thinking about the behaviors that unite us, because behaviors are really what matter at the end of the day when we're developing products. And I presented this whole idea to a group of people and one of them came up to me. What she did, which she is a designer working for a library system at a university. So lots, you know, creating these environments for people to learn. And she was really like rethinking her personas. And she had like, you know, undergraduates and graduates and researchers, you know, kind of split up like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what are some other ways that we can think about these groups? You know, maybe instead of having it split by demographic, because that you're still doing that, right? Because undergrads are a demographic versus the graduates. I'm like, what if we united them based on behaviors? Like the people who like to be in groups at the library studying together versus the solo person who needs their quiet space, right? Mm-hmm. Those are totally different behaviors that need a different experience at the library, but it could span undergraduate or graduate or research. You know, like it doesn't matter what the demographic is.
Yep.
And so by thinking of flipping it on its head and starting with the behaviors first, I think we do a much better job of serving those people. I mean, if you think about it, like, starting with demographics is as absurd, right, as using astrology to group people, right? So I'm a Cancer, so therefore let's design for the Cancers.
Obviously,
in the room.
They're different than the Sagittarius is over right here.
Exactly. Exactly. And the thing is, it colors our perspective, yeah, right? Because if you know that I'm a Cancer, you're going to say, oh, she's a homebody. She does all this stuff, and ignore my obvious Leo qualities that are coming through, right? We just don't see them. We
yeah
totally colored our perspective. So behaviors first. I like adding context to personas, a lot more of the storytelling. People respond to stories. I mean, that's what humans are all about, right? We sat around thousands of years ago telling stories around a fire. That's what we're built to yep understand. So context, but also being specific. I always see this on personas from students, like something like they have under a pain point, they put time. That is like, what about time? too much time? How much?
I mean, time, like, they're bored. They can't tell time. What are we doing here?
Exactly. I mean, I can assume, right? But, you know, I used to be a television news producer. Mm-hmm. And you don't assume when you're in journalism. You have to back everything up by facts. So we had to be very specific about things. And I think we should do the same thing in our personas, you know? So it's a whole different way to think about how we create these things. And I like pairing a persona with a customer journey map, because you can get into a specific, like, day in the life or, you know, some sort of experience that they're having that's time boxed, and really get into the details of what this person is going through. And it can really help us craft an experience that is going to be more inclusive, more thoughtful, and definitely more helpful for when we turn, you know, hand it off to the developers and they're trying to figure out what's going mm-hmm. on as well, you know?
Or when we talk about buyer personas and personas that we build for marketing and sales teams, it's the same kind of thing, right? What the difference in the picture you can draw in my head through the behaviors and the context and the story, like, I know what to do with that. I can extend that, right? It gives me depth of which I can, like, build on. And if you just give me the demographics, it doesn't work. And the other thing is, everybody always starts with the statement that personas aren't stereotypes. But if all I do then is give you back the demographics, that is, in an essence, like, that's the stereotype, right?
Totally. Totally. Yeah. Because, like, you know, like, if you say, oh, they're a 45-year-old mom. Well, that immediately creates a stereotype in your mind and you make assumptions about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't help it. That's what our brain does. So you have to work against it in the persona.
And if you do, and it's one of those things, because it's like, the bad personas aren't helpful at all. A good persona is a game changer for helping the entire organization understand who we are solving problems for, who are we helping to reach their goals, and the how that best makes sense to accomplish, right? It's a whole different level of context in the organization. That really is, it empowers everyone in that organization to make better contributions and to use their talents and skills wholly, because they have sort of the vision of who and what. That if we just say, oh, these most personas are bad, we shouldn't use them, we lose a lot. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And that story that comes with it, that gives us a mental picture. And then it doesn't matter what image we stick onto the persona. Like, do we even need an image at that point?
No.
Other than, like, an illustration or something, right? Like, because then that, like, how different would you look at it if it was like someone with light skin versus dark skin versus, you know, old versus young? Like, we do the stereotyping just based on the image.
Yeah.
But if we tell the story, then mm-hmm. it becomes our own image of who that person is.
Right? Because it's like when you read a book and then you see the movie and you're like, that's not how they looked in my head.
Yes, exactly. Which
is so I was thinking about, like, one of the things I struggle with the illustrations is it's very flat, right? It's like very caricature also. And so I'm like, oh, that doesn't feel as real. But then on the other hand, like, if I have the story, I will make the image in my head and I will pull up my image. And now, because I built it from the story, it may still have some of those stereotypes, but it's how I interpreted the story. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Cause I've always struggled. I have struggled with the illustration. I totally agree. I bring in so much elsewhere, but the humanity of it is also important, right?
Right. Right. It is. But if we tell a good story,
yep.
they are still human.
Right. I can still picture them in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so the last topic is one that all of us are fascinated and horrified, both? No, mostly fascinated, but also, like, there's tons of questions, right? When we're all talking about generative AI, right? ChatGPT mm-hmm. or any of the other bazillion tools out there. And there's so much potential and there's so much, like, made up ways we could use it as well. And I think thinking about it in terms of design, both in terms of how design can help AI be better. That makes sense, right? Some mm-hmm. of the design structures and helping those models do better, and also how AI can and can't help us either now or in the foreseeable future. It moves, like, at the speed of everything, right? Every Friday, giant releases are done. I think it's just a really interesting topic to dig in on.
Oh, I've been thinking a lot about AI, and I can't say that I am any kind of expert mm-hmm. at all on it.
Me either. Curious.
I find it, yes, exactly. And of course, as a human, I am terrible at predicting the future, right? So I'll take all of this with a grain of salt. But I don't think I know we can't ignore it. No. We absolutely can't ignore it. We're going to have to embrace it. But I feel like, you know, people listening probably haven't even like thought about the late 90s. It was the wild, wild west of the web,
yes,
right?
Like the same compare. I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Yes.
Yeah. That's what it's like with the AI stuff. So there's so much that hasn't been created that will be created. And it is exciting and yet terrifying all at the same time because of all the different predictions that are coming out there about, oh, it's going to take our jobs. Oh, it's not going to take our jobs. I'm not so worried about that as thinking about the fact that as designers, we are in a unique position to shape what is done with AI. We don't have to let it shape us.
Yes.
We can shape it. And we need to take a seat at the decision-making table and help craft what we're going to use it for and how we're going to use it. And it might come by us experimenting with different techniques. Does it work for user research? Does it work for creating website layouts? You know, or do we need to go bespoke? You know, like
right.
So
yeah.
That kind of thing, right? We need to try it all and figure out what's working and what's not, and then help craft those rules around it, because there's a lot of ethical things that are happening too in terms of, you know, taking other people's ideas or artwork or, you know, putting people at risk for, you know, having just wrong or not just inaccurate, but also racist information out there.
Absolutely.
Like there's a lot, right? We're just going to have to try it and see what's working and what doesn't, and hopefully figure out avenues to do that trying out without putting our own careers at risk, you know?
Right.
I don't feel good about some of the things that are coming out. Like there's one that has like AI users that you can test on. I just don't know where is that data coming from? How are they creating these people? Or is it stereotypes, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
What are they using? I mean, are they using those really terrible personas to create those? We don't know, right? So I think we're going to have to like be real honest as an industry about like what we're using for our roles, and also with our companies who are going to ask for us to do that.
Right.
You know?
They're going to expect. So it takes you, you know, 4 weeks to do this. Now with AI, you could do it in 4 days, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's going to be I don't think it's just going to be one skill that we add to our portfolio. I think we're going to have to learn a lot of different skills in terms of learning to use the AI. And that will be an essential, you know, they always, I don't remember exactly where it came from, but the computer can always beat the human. But when the computer and the human work together, they beat everything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we will have to learn how to use the computer, but we've done this before.
Yeah. Yes.
You know,
people of our age will remember that like everything changed and it was good. There were moments, but it wasn't, you know, there were all kinds of jobs in the 80s and 90s way back then. Mm-hmm. People worked at Blockbusters, my friends. right. And they've changed drastically, but for overall, right, there wasn't a mass thing. And I think both that I hope that sort of design leaders can make sure that as these models come out, that I think designers can be really important in helping to design these models, thinking about things like bias and thinking about things like discrimination in a way that is going to be a really, really important, like in the training and coding of the model to limit the amount of pain up front or a down end. So that's like on the global, like, should there ever be a leadership group on this AI overall, it's got to have a whole bunch of good designers on there to help shape that well. But also to your point, at the individual level, while it is not perfect now, it is our job to test it and see where it does work and inform, right?
Yeah.
To say, it'd be great to do that in 4 days. Here's the limitations, right? Here's the risks and here's the places. But just being like, it's hype. There are 100%. There's a ton of hype in there, but this is not a time to like stick your head in the sand and wait for others to show.
Yeah. And I worry, right? Because a lot of the boot camp programs focus on the technical skills around design, like how to use Figma and things like that, right? But we are moving in a direction where designers who implement are going to be pushed out toward the more strategic thinkers. yep. who are thinking about how to do this. And there's a meme floating around LinkedIn right now where it's like, you know, the agency person is like, the AI will help as long as the client knows exactly what they want. We're safe. Right? They don't. They need right. us. We're going to become guides.
Yes.
We're going to be helping them think through it and then using the technology to make that happen. And that's, so to go back to your earlier question about the skills, going to have to learn to be critical thinkers.
Yeah.
To be strategic thinkers, because pushing pixels ain't it.
No.
It's just not going to, somebody's, the computer's going to do it for you.
Right. And that's, and in some ways you should think of that as a really good thing, because it will give you time for some of these other places that we shortchange. But it does mean that that's going to be where the differentiation comes from for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Is understanding that piece 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, AI takes what information has already been fed into it. It's not coming up with new stuff. No. That's, humans can do that.
Right. It's all derivative work, right? I mean, that is yes. that is how it works today, yep. which is also where we've all seen that when it's like a giant game of telephone, right? At some point, the answer is going to get worse. So figuring out how to use it the right way, I think it's a super interesting time. And I think, you know, it's probably a little bit like the internet, where it existed for a long time before it was accessible to the audience. And that's true here, right? Mm-hmm. The difference with ChatGPT, it's not different technology. What they did is just make it so incredibly accessible yes. for so many people. And that's yeah. where we start to see lots of good things and lots of bad things or potentially bad things come out at once. But it's also, mm-hmm. you know, I think it will grow in more interesting ways than people would have necessarily predicted. So that's yeah. what's good.
So get comfortable with that ambiguity. Right? Just don't know what's going to happen next.
Right? Just be curious, right? That's yeah. the other piece. So we talked about like always learning, be curious, see how yes. these things are happening, and then gives you an opportunity to shape it. Yeah. We talked about all kinds of things today. We talked about, you know, chicken sexing, and we talked about we talked about AI and personas. If you were going to have people do two things differently tomorrow, if you could get them to just do two changes tomorrow, two new behaviors, two new things, what would you have them do?
Really think about how your brain is reacting to other people. Mm-hmm. I would think about that first, because you're when you don't notice, you just kind of go on autopilot. So yeah. being aware, and you're, that brings in the woo-woo, but it is to be good to be aware. And the other thing is to get out there and practice being a critical thinker, practice mm-hmm. the strategic thinking. That is going to serve you so well in the long run. And you're going to be a much better partner to the people that you work with overall, and even help you with stakeholders. It's going to just reap you're going to reap the rewards.
Think about how you're responding and then work on your critical thinking. Love it.
Yes.
Very good yep. advice. Cindy, this has been a blast. If people want to learn more about kind of your thinking, or you mentioned, oh, I'm going to write a blog about this, where is the best place for them to follow you?
Oh, please follow me on LinkedIn. I'm Cindy Brummer. It's pretty easy to find me. I think there's two others out there in the world. And then our website, standardbeagle.com.
Excellent. All right, Cindy, thank you so much for joining us today. It was absolutely a blast talking to you.
Oh, it was fun to talk to you too, Rebecca. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, that does it for today's episode. Thank you everyone for listening. And don't forget to join us next time when we cover another great topic. Thanks.